This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Story one. I've never told anyone this in full detail because honestly, I'm not sure anyone would believe me. But if you're reading this, I hope you understand just how close I came to losing everything. My life, my friends, maybe even my sanity. It happened during the summer of 2012. I was living in a small town in southern Missouri, the kind of place where folks swap gossip at the gas station, and tornado sirens are as familiar as church bells. A few friends and I had decided to escape the grind of daily life by camping out in the Ozark National Forest. We were a mixed group of free spirits, musicians, artists, and wanderers, all looking for something out there. What that something was, I don't know. Maybe it was peace, maybe it was chaos. Either way, we found it. The day started out sticky and humid, a thick blanket of air hanging over us as we set up our little camp near a ravine. We'd been there about a week by then. That's when the first rumble of thunder rolled across the sky. The forecast had called for rain, sure, but this was different. This was the kind of thunder that shakes you to your core. A low, guttural growl that seemed to rise out of the earth itself. "Y'all hear that?" I asked, looking up at the others. They were sprawled out on a patch of mossy ground, passing around a battered acoustic guitar and talking about nothing in particular. "Storm's coming," Jake said, strumming a lazy chord. His voice didn't match the tension building in the air. It was as if the forest was holding its breath. Then came the sirens. Faint at first, just a distant wail carried on the wind, but unmistakable. Tornado sirens. Everyone froze, their faces snapping to attention like deer caught in headlights. "We've got to move," I said, standing up so fast my head spun. I wasn't from the area, but I'd heard enough stories to know these storms don't play around. "Get your stuff and follow me." Most of them hesitated, their movements sluggish as they packed up. Some of them were high, some just naive. But I didn't have time to argue. The sky had turned an eerie greenish-gray, and the wind was picking up, rattling the trees above us. Branches creaked and groaned like old doors. "Where are we going?" asked Mia, her voice trembling as she struggled with her backpack. "Down," I said. "We need to find low ground." The ravine seemed like our best bet. It wasn't far from where we'd set up camp, and I figured the rocks would offer some shelter from flying debris. But as we scrambled down, I realized we had another problem. The river running through the ravine was already swelling from the rain, which had started falling in the thick, fat drops. The air was electric, crackling with something primal and dangerous. We found a spot near a 2-tier shale waterfall, crouching beneath an overhang of rock. It wasn't perfect, but it was the best we could do. I could feel the tension in the group, a collective unease that had nothing to do with the weather. "This isn't safe," Jake muttered, his earlier bravado gone. He was gripping a broken tree branch like it was a lifeline. "Nowhere safe right now," I snapped, my voice harsher than I intended. "Just stay low and keep quiet." The wind howled through the ravine and the rain turned into a torrential downpour. Then came the sound I'll never forget. It wasn't just a roar, it was a living, breathing thing. The river, swollen and furious, surged with terrifying speed. I turned just in time to see it. A wall of water barreling down the ravine like some unstoppable force of nature. It was easily 15 feet high, dark and churning with debris. "Hold on," I shouted, though I wasn't sure what we were supposed to hold on to. The ground beneath us trembled as the floodwaters smashed against the rocks, spraying us with icy mist. The noise was deafening, A cacophony of crashing water, snapping branches, and our own panicked breaths. We huddled together, clinging to the rocky outcrop as the water rushed past, mere feet below us. For a moment, time seemed to stretch, each second an eternity. My heart pounded so hard I thought it might burst. And then, it was over. The water receded as quickly as it had come, leaving behind a scene of utter devastation. Trees had been uprooted, their massive trunks tangled in the remnants of the torrent. The air was thick with the smell of wet earth and something metallic, like blood. "Is everyone okay?" I asked, my voice barely audible over the ringing in my ears. One by one they nodded, their faces pale and shell-shocked. We didn't speak much after that. There was nothing to say. We climbed out of the ravine in silence, our clothes soaked and our spirits battered. I don't think any of us ever went back to that spot. The forest had shown us just how small we were, how fragile, and that was enough to haunt me for a lifetime. Story 2. It all happened on a Tuesday morning, the kind where the world feels oddly still. My name's Caleb, and I live in a small mountain town called Ridgeview. We're surrounded by steep inclines and dense pine forests. Life here is simple, quiet, but the kind of quiet that carries an edge, like something's always waiting just out of sight. That's probably why I never thought twice about heading up that winding dirt road alone that morning. I was driving my old pickup truck, a clunky but reliable beast that had seen its fair share of tough roads. I'd planned to collect some firewood from the higher elevations. With winter on its way, everyone in Ridgeview knew to stock up. The road was narrow.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Barely wide enough for one vehicle, with sheer drops on one side and jagged boulders scattered along the other. I'd driven it dozens of times before, so I wasn't worried. Not yet, anyway. About halfway up the mountain, the air started to change. A thick fog rolled in out of nowhere, blanketing everything in a gray haze. Visibility dropped to almost nothing. I slowed to a crawl, my hands gripping the wheel tighter than I'd like to admit. The tires crunched over loose gravel, and I couldn't shake the feeling that the mountain itself was watching me. Then it happened. The truck's back tires hit a patch of loose dirt, and before I knew it, the whole thing started sliding. Time stretched out in that moment. I remember the sickening lurch in my stomach, the way the steering wheel felt useless in my hands as the truck veered toward the edge. My heart was pounding so loud it drowned out the sound of gravel scattering under the tires. "No, no, no," I yelled, yanking the wheel to the right, but it was no use. The truck tipped, the passenger side lifting off the ground as the weight shifted. I could see the drop now, hundreds of feet down into a mess of rocks and trees, and then a jolt. The truck slammed into something solid. My head snapped forward, hitting the steering wheel. Stars danced in my vision, but I was alive, barely. When I opened my eyes, I realized what had stopped me. A massive boulder, weathered and gray, had wedged itself under the truck's frame, 3 inches to the left or right, and it would have missed entirely. I would have been nothing more than a headline in the local paper. Man found dead after truck plunges off mountain road. My hands were trembling as I turned the ignition off. I didn't dare move, afraid any shift in weight might dislodge the precarious balance. The boulder groaned under the truck's weight, and I could hear the faint creak of metal protesting against gravity. "Okay, Caleb," I muttered to myself, trying to stay calm. "Think. You just gotta get out. Easy does it." I unbuckled my seatbelt, every motion feeling like it took an eternity. The door on the driver's side was wedged against the rock wall, so I had no choice but to crawl over to the passenger side. With every shift of my weight, the truck groaned louder. My breath caught in my throat when I felt it tilt ever so slightly. Finally, I managed to get the passenger door open. The fog had thickened even more, swirling like smoke around me. I could barely see the ground below the truck, but I had no choice. I grabbed the edge of the doorframe and swung my legs out, praying the truck wouldn't give way. The moment my boots hit solid ground, I ran. I didn't stop to look back, didn't stop to think. My legs carried me down the mountain faster than I'd ever moved in my life. Adrenaline and sheer terror were the only things keeping me upright as I stumbled over rocks and roots. It wasn't until I reached a clearing, a good half mile down, that I allowed myself to stop. My chest heaved, and my hands were scraped and bloodied from the fall. I looked back up the mountain, but the fog had swallowed everything. For a moment, I wondered if it had all been some kind of hallucination, a cruel trick of the mind. But then I saw the faint outline of the truck, still perched on that boulder, like a warning. I made it back to Ridgeview that afternoon, shaking and pale. When I told my story at the local diner, no one believed me at first. "You've got the luck of the devil," old Mr. Barrett said, shaking his head. Maybe he was right. That boulder saved my life. But to this day, I can't shake the feeling that something else was at play. It wasn't just luck. It was too perfect, too precise. Sometimes, late at night, I think about that fog and the way it rolled in out of nowhere. It's the kind of thing that makes you question everything, that leaves you wondering if the mountain wanted me dead or if it had decided for some reason to let me live. Story 3. It was a regular Tuesday morning, or so I thought. My name's Tim, and I live in Wichita, Kansas. I'm just your average office worker, the kind who punches in at 9 and punches out at 5, counting down the hours in between. That day started like any other: coffee, a bagel, and the endless loop of emails. But by lunch, things took a turn that I can only describe as surreal. It started with a strange feeling, almost like I wasn't entirely in my body. Not an out-of-body experience per se, but a sensation that I was just a fraction off, like my soul had shifted a couple of inches to the left. The fluorescent lights above my desk felt harsh, their flicker more noticeable than usual. The hum of the office buzzed in slow motion. I was present, but not quite there. "Tim, you good?" my co-worker Steve asked. He's one of those guys who's annoyingly observant. But at that moment, I was grateful for it. I don't feel right," I admitted, my voice sounding distant to my own ears. "Not right like flu not right? Or not right like ER not right?" His tone turned serious. He could tell this wasn't a run-of-the-mill complaint. "Maybe urgent care," I mumbled, trying to stay calm. He grabbed his keys without hesitation. "Let's go." At the clinic, the nurse checked my blood pressure, and her expression immediately shifted. "Sir, you're going to need to head to an emergency room. There's 1 5 minutes from here." Okay, sure," I replied, still feeling like I was observing the scene from outside my body. The drive there felt like it was happening in a dream. Everything blurry, the world moving at half speed. The ER was unusually quiet, almost unnervingly so. Within minutes, I was hooked up to machines, nurses whispering to each other as they worked. A doctor appeared at my side, her face set in a professional mask, but her eyes betrayed her concern. "Tim, we're going to move you upstairs to the ICU," she said, her voice calm but firm. "Your blood pressure is dangerously high. We need to get it under control immediately." The words hit me like a truck. ICU? That's for people who are dying. That's for people who don't leave the hospital. They wheeled me upstairs, the fluorescent lights blurring overhead. In the ICU, the room was eerily quiet except for the rhythmic beeping of the machines. I lay there staring at the clock on the wall, watching the seconds tick by. I couldn't help but notice how carefully the nurses moved, their voices hushed as they communicated. One nurse leaned over me, her face kind but tense. "We've given you some medication to bring your pressure down. Just relax. You're in good hands." But relaxing was impossible. I could feel the panic bubbling just below the surface. My chest felt tight, my head pounding like a drum. The world around me felt unreal, like I was teetering on the edge of consciousness. As I lay there trying to calm my racing thoughts, something changed in the room. The air grew heavier, pressing down on my chest in a way that had nothing to do with my condition. The clock on the wall seemed to slow even further, each tick stretching into an eternity. I turned my head to look at the doorway, and that's when I saw it. A shadow, stood just outside the room. It wasn't shaped like a person, not exactly. It was too tall, its limbs too elongated, and its edges seemed to blur and waver like smoke. The lights in the hallway flickered, and for a moment it felt like the entire hospital had gone silent. Even the machines around me seemed to pause, their beeping replaced by a low hum that vibrated through my skull. I tried to call out, but my voice caught in my throat. The shadow moved closer, stepping into the room. It didn't walk. It glided as though the floor didn't exist. My heart raced faster than ever, the machines beside me screaming with alarm. The figure stopped at the foot of my bed, and though it had no face, I felt its gaze pierce through me. "Tim," it whispered, the sound like a thousand voices layered on top of each other. "You were not supposed to leave." "Leave? Leave where?" My mind reeled, unable to make sense of the words. The shadow reached out a hand, or what I assumed was a hand, long spindly fingers stretching toward me. Cold radiated from it, chilling me to my core. I wanted to scream, to fight, but my body wouldn't respond. I was frozen, trapped in my own skin. Just as its fingers brushed against my arm, the door to the room burst open. A nurse rushed in, followed by the doctor. The shadow recoiled, fading into the corner of the room before disappearing entirely. The lights returned to normal, and the beeping of the machines filled the air once more. "Tim, stay with us!" the doctor shouted, her hands moving quickly to adjust the equipment. The nurse injected something into my IV, and within moments, the crushing weight on my chest lifted. My body relaxed and the world came rushing back. I didn't tell them what I saw. How could I? They'd chalk it up to the stress, the medication, the dangerously high blood pressure. But I knew better. That shadow wasn't a hallucination. It was something else, something real. And its words still haunt me to this day. "You were not supposed to leave." I'm alive now, and my health is better than it was before. Story 4. I grew up in Vermont, where snow wasn't just a season, it was a way of life. Winters there were like something out of a postcard, all frosted pine trees and glittering hills. I'm no stranger to the cold or the dangers of snow, but this one night I realized how unforgiving it could be. I was visiting a ski resort with some friends. By day the place was a noisy playground for skiers and snowboarders, but at night it transformed into something quiet, almost eerie. We'd all been at the lodge drinking by the fire when I decided to step outside for a bit of fresh air. I didn't bother telling anyone. I just grabbed my coat and walked out, leaving the warmth behind. It wasn't snowing, but the air had that biting chill that seeped through your clothes. The moon was bright, lighting up the endless white expanse. It was peaceful, almost hypnotic, and I wandered further than I realized, crunching over untouched patches of snow. I remember thinking how surreal it was. Just me in the winter night. And then the ground disappeared. I didn't even have time to scream before I plunged into the snow. One moment, I was upright. The next, I was buried up to my shoulders in what felt like quicksand made of ice. My arms flailed, but every movement made the snow collapse further around me, pulling me in deeper. I froze. Panic was creeping in, but I forced myself to breathe. I tried to move slowly, thinking I could push the snow down enough to climb out. It didn't work. The more I shifted, the more it swallowed me. My gloves were useless. They slid against the soft, powdery snow. I yelled for help, my voice echoing into the void, but I knew no one would hear me. The lodge was too far, and the wind carried sound away like it didn't belong. That's when it hit me. If I didn't get out, no one would find me until morning. By then, I'd be frozen solid. I started digging with my hands, desperate now, but it was like trying to claw through water. I remember thinking about all the stories I'd heard as a kid about people who went missing in the snow. They'd find their bodies months later, perfectly preserved, as if winter itself had claimed them. And then the strangest thing happened. I felt something or someone grab my arm. It was sudden, a firm grip, like a hand reaching through the snow. Relief surged through me. Someone must have found me. I called out, "Thank you, I'm stuck." But there was no answer. I looked up, expecting to see a face, but there was no one there. Just the moonlit snow, untouched except for the hole I'd fallen into. The grip didn't let go, though. If anything, it tightened, pulling me downward. My relief turned to terror. I screamed, thrashing against whatever had me. But the harder I fought, the more it pulled. It felt cold, colder than the snow, and impossibly strong. My legs were completely numb now, and I could feel myself sinking deeper. "Let me go," I shouted, my voice cracking with fear. And just like that, it stopped. The grip released, and I was left gasping, chest heaving, frozen in place. I didn't waste a second. I clawed at the snow with everything I had, dragging myself out inch by inch until I was finally free. I didn't look back. I couldn't. I ran, stumbling and slipping, until I saw the lights of the lodge. When I burst through the doors, my friends turned to me, laughing at first until they saw my face. "What happened to you?" one of them asked. I couldn't explain it. How do you tell someone about a hand that wasn't there? About being pulled by something you couldn't see? I didn't sleep that night or the next. Even now, years later, I can still feel that icy grip on my arm. Sometimes in my dreams, I'm back there, sinking into the snow, and I wake up gasping, my heart pounding. I've avoided ski resorts ever since. Snow might look beautiful under the moonlight, but I know better now. It hides things. Things that don't let go. Story 5. I was 17 when it happened, living in a small town in Montana where the winters seemed endless, and the roads disappeared under thick layers of snow and ice. You could walk a mile without seeing a single house lit up at night. My dad always joked that this place was perfect if you liked the quiet. The kind of quiet that could swallow you whole. That night it almost did. I had just finished a shift at the diner where I worked after school. It was a cold Tuesday, and I was walking home because my car was in the shop. My breath fogged up the air in front of me, and the only sound was the crunch of my boots on the icy road. The town was deserted, not a soul in sight, and the streetlights barely pushed back the darkness. The walk from the diner to my house wasn't long, maybe 20 minutes, but it took me through a stretch of wooded road that always gave me the creeps. Something about the way the trees closed in made it feel like the shadows had eyes. I'd walked this road 100 times before, but that night felt different, like the cold wasn't just outside but inside me, clawing at my gut. I kept telling myself I was being paranoid, but I picked up my pace anyway. About halfway through the wooded stretch, I saw headlights in the distance. A car was coming up behind me, slow and deliberate. At first, I thought it was someone I knew. A neighbor, maybe, offering me a ride. But the car didn't pass me. It just rolled forward at a crawl, staying a few feet behind. The sound of the tires crunching on the ice matched my footsteps. I turned around, squinting against the glare of the headlights, and raised a hand to wave. No response. Just the hum of the engine and the blinding light. My gut tightened. Something was wrong. Really wrong. I stepped to the side of the road to let it pass, but the car stopped. Dead stop. My heart started pounding as I turned back toward the trees. "Keep walking," I whispered to myself. "Just keep walking." I tried to act normal, like I didn't notice the car, but my legs felt like jelly. The headlights flicked off, plunging the road into darkness. That's when I heard the car door open. A single heavy footstep hit the icy road, then another. "Hey," a voice called out, deep, raspy. "You need a ride?" My stomach dropped. I didn't turn around. "No, I'm good, thanks," I shouted, trying to sound casual. My voice cracked halfway through. The footsteps started again, faster this time. I could hear them crunching behind me, closing the gap. I didn't think. I just ran. My boots slipped on the ice, but adrenaline kept me moving. The trees blurred as I sprinted down the road, my breath coming in short, sharp gasps. I didn't dare look back. "Hey, stop!" the voice shouted, closer now. My mind raced with thoughts I couldn't finish. Who was this guy? What did he want? What would happen if he caught me? I saw a narrow path veering off into the woods and darted onto it, hoping the thick trees would slow him down. My lungs burned and my legs screamed for rest, but I didn't stop. I could hear him crashing through the underbrush behind me, his heavy boots snapping branches and crunching snow. The sound was relentless, like a nightmare I couldn't wake up from. Then suddenly, silence. I stopped, chest heaving, and leaned against a tree. My ears strained against the quiet. Nothing. No footsteps, no voice. Just the eerie stillness of the forest. I'd lost him, or so I thought. As I stood there trying to catch my breath, a sound cut through the quiet, a soft, deliberate crunch of snow directly ahead of me. My head snapped up. A shadow moved between the trees, tall and broad. He had circled around. My heart felt like it was going to explode. I turned and bolted in the opposite direction, but my foot hit a patch of ice, and I went down hard. Pain shot through my wrist as I landed, but I barely noticed. I scrambled to my feet, slipping and sliding, and kept running. The trees began to thin, and I saw the faint glow of a house in the distance. "Help! Someone, please!" I screamed, my voice echoing through the woods. The shadow behind me hesitated, then stopped. Maybe he heard the desperation in my voice, or maybe he saw the lights and decided it wasn't worth it. Either way, he didn't follow me. By the time I reached the house, I was sobbing, banging on the door like my life depended on it. An older couple answered, their faces a mix of concern and confusion. I babbled something about a man chasing me, and they pulled me inside without hesitation. The police were called, but they didn't find anyone. No car, no footprints. Just an empty road in my shaken story. They said it was probably some drifter trying to scare me, or maybe even my imagination playing tricks in the dark. But I know what I heard. I know what I felt. Story 6. I grew up in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, where water parks were the summer escape. My family loved them, especially my dad. He had this thing about chasing thrills, always grinning like a maniac whenever he dragged us into his next harebrained scheme. That's how we ended up at Splash Haven, a place I'll never forget for all the wrong reasons. The day was stiflingly hot, the kind where the air itself feels heavy. Kids shrieked, lifeguards barked orders, and the chlorine smell was so overpowering, it made my eyes water. My dad, older brother Mike, younger sister Emma, and I made our way to the Riptide Rush, a water slide so massive it cast a shadow over half the park. The thing spiraled and twisted like a snake, before spitting riders out into a shallow breaking pool. Dad, with that grin of his, clapped his hands together. "Let's do a family train. You know, link up the tubes. It'll be fun." Even then, I had a bad feeling about it. "I don't think that's allowed," I mumbled. But Dad's enthusiasm was infectious. He waved off my concerns. "Relax, it'll be fine. What could go wrong?" That's a question you never want answered. We lined up. I got stuck in the front, my smaller frame making me the easiest target for Mike and Dad's weight to push forward. Mike settled behind me, his linebacker shoulders dwarfing his tube. Dad came next, his laugh booming as Emma climbed into the last tube, clutching the handles like her life depended on it. The lifeguard gave us a skeptical glance but said nothing as we shoved off. From the first twist, it was chaos. The combined weight of Mike and Dad turned us into a runaway freight train. Water roared around us, and the slide walls blurred as we hurtled through each curve. My knuckles whitened as I clung to my tube, my heart pounding in my ears. "Slow down!" I screamed, but my voice was lost in the cacophony. Everyone else was laughing like lunatics. As we neared the final stretch, a straightaway leading into the breaking pool, dread clawed at my chest. We weren't slowing down. If anything, we were speeding up. The surface of the pool glittered like glass, and beyond it, the unforgiving stone stairs loomed closer with every second. "We're going too fast!" I yelled, my voice cracking. And then we hit. My tube slammed into the water, but instead of slowing down, it skimmed across like it was possessed. The edge of my tube caught on something, flipping me forward. My back crashed against the jagged stairs, pain exploding through me as my legs folded awkwardly. Before I could scream, Dad's tube slammed into me, driving me deeper against the stairs. That's when I realized my head was underwater. I opened my mouth to gasp, and icy water filled my lungs. My chest burned, my spine screamed in protest, and I could feel the rough stone grinding against my skin. The world above the surface blurred into chaos. My own gurgling cries were drowned out by the roar of water and the muffled sounds of shouting. Then it got worse. Something cold brushed against my arm. At first, I thought it was a strap from my tube, but then it moved, deliberately. My heart froze as what felt like a hand tightened around my wrist. I thrashed, trying to pull free, but the grip only tightened. My mind raced. Was it debris? A stray rope? Number it felt human. Panic set in as I flailed, my movements sluggish under the weight of water and pain. The grip on my wrist jerked, yanking me deeper into the water. My back scraped against the stairs, and I swear I heard something crack. Above the surface, distorted by the water, I saw my dad's face, eyes wide with terror. He was shouting, his voice barely cutting through the haze. And then, just as suddenly as it appeared, the grip vanished. A violent tug pulled me upward, and I broke the surface, coughing and choking. My dad had yanked me out, his arms trembling as he dragged me onto the concrete. I collapsed in a heap, my chest heaving as I sucked in air. Oh my God, Dad kept muttering, his voice shaky. Mike and Emma were there too, their faces pale as they hovered over me. The lifeguard sprinted over, his whistle shrieking. Can you move? Are you hurt? He asked, his tone urgent. I couldn't answer. My back felt like it was on fire, and my legs were trembling so hard I couldn't stand. As I lay there, shivering and disoriented, I glanced back at the pool. For a split second, I thought I saw something. A shadow slipping beneath the surface, too large and too fast to be a trick of the light. My dad must have seen my face because he crouched next to me and grabbed my hand. It's over, he said softly, his voice breaking. You're okay. You're safe now. But I wasn't. Not really. That shadow, that grip on my wrist. It wasn't normal. Something was in that pool. Story 7. You ever have one of those moments that stays with you? Not like a memory, but like a weight pressed against your chest that tightens every time it crosses your mind? I live in a small town in western Oregon, surrounded by thick pine forests and hills that never dry out, not even in summer. My name's Marcus. I'm 32 now, but this happened when I was 11. I still have dreams about it. Sometimes they're so vivid I'll wake up gasping, heart pounding like I'm falling all over again. Back then, we had this tradition. Me and two of my friends, Danny and Leo, we'd head out into the woods behind my neighborhood and just wander. We'd build forts, throw rocks at trees, climb stuff. We were too old for toys, but too young for girls, so we climbed everything, especially trees. There was this one tree we called the Spire. It was the tallest one in the area, a Douglas fir that had to be at least 100 feet tall, way taller than anything nearby. The trunk was thick, straight, and covered in tight branches almost all the way up. It didn't curve until maybe 90 feet or so. It looked like something out of a cartoon, perfect for climbing if you were stupid enough. And I was. I still don't know what got into me that day. We were daring each other to see who could climb the highest, and I just went for it. Danny stopped maybe 20 feet up, Leo maybe 30. I didn't stop. I don't think I even looked down. I just kept grabbing, pulling, stepping on smaller and smaller branches until I realized I couldn't hear them anymore. They weren't calling to me. They were way below. When I finally did look down, I nearly blacked out. The ground was so far it looked like a patchwork of moss and dirt, unreal and distant. The tree wasn't still either. At that height, every gust of wind pushed the top back and forth in these huge, slow swings, probably 15, 20 feet side to side. I swear I could hear the tree creaking. That's when panic hit me. My hands locked around the branch in front of me. I didn't trust any step, didn't think anything below would hold if I tried to go back. And then the thought slammed into my brain like a punch. If I fell, I'd die. That wasn't a maybe. It was just fact. Marcus! I could faintly hear Leo yelling. Come down, man! I'm stuck, I shouted back, voice shaking. I can't. The wind picked up again, and the whole top of the tree swayed with me clinging to it. My stomach flipped so hard I gagged. I don't know how long I stayed up there. Could have been 15 minutes, could have been an hour. Time stopped meaning anything. I just remember how my muscles burned from holding on, and how my legs started to cramp from being in that weird crouch on the narrow branch. Eventually, I knew I had to move, or I'd fall just from fatigue. I started easing down slowly, inch by inch, telling myself not to look down, but of course I did. Everything below was still blurry and too far, and now it was starting to rain. One of those light Oregon drizzles that makes every surface slick without you noticing. One branch cracked under my foot. Not all the way, just enough to make that loud snap that gets under your skin. I jerked my leg up so fast I nearly lost balance. Heart thudding so hard I could feel it in my throat. I made it down maybe 15 feet before it happened. My left foot missed. The branch I meant to step on wasn't there. I went weightless. That's the only way I can describe it. Like my body disappeared, and I was just this shape falling through air. I remember this horrible whipping sound as the wind rushed past my ears. And in that moment, it wasn't panic I felt. It was clarity. I saw myself sprawled on the forest floor, bones bent the wrong way, neck twisted. I don't know how to explain that. I saw it, like an image forced into my brain. My face pale and wide-eyed, mouth stuck open. Dead, not scared, not screaming, just broken. I don't even know if that was imagination or some weird hallucination, but it was real to me. Still is. I didn't fall all the way, though. Something caught me, not a branch. I was sure I'd passed the last big one. It felt like hands. Two cold, hard grips wrapped around my forearms and stopped me midair. I didn't see anyone. I looked around frantically, but there was no one there. No one above me, no one below. Just me hanging, breathless, rain falling around me, gripped by something invisible. For maybe 3 seconds, I dangled there. Long enough to think, I'm dead. This is it. Something's taking me. Then I dropped the last few feet onto a branch that cracked but held. I clawed onto the trunk like an animal, crying, shaking, half hysterical. I screamed for help. Danny and Leo were at the base of the tree shouting back up, but I could barely hear them. My ears were ringing. I kept yelling, "There's something up here!" But I don't think they understood. I scrambled down so fast I tore my palms open. My shirt got snagged, ripped across the back. I didn't care. I hit the forest floor knees first and collapsed, sobbing, mud all over me. Leo ran up and grabbed me by the shoulders. "Dude, what happened? You just dropped." "I didn't fall," I whispered. "Something caught me." Danny looked up at the tree. "What do you mean?" "I don't know." I was shaking too hard to talk right. "It grabbed me. I swear to God, it grabbed me." They thought I was just in shock. I didn't blame them. I didn't climb another tree after that. Not once. It's been over 20 years and I still don't have an explanation. I've replayed it 100 times in my head, wondering if I imagined the whole thing, but I didn't. I know what I felt. The fingers, the grip, that freezing touch. Whatever it was, it didn't want me to die just yet, but it didn't want me safe either. I don't go near the woods anymore, and I'll never climb again. Story 8. I grew up in a small town called Auburn, out in Northern California, tucked between thick pine woods and winding two-lane highways. I don't live there anymore, but I still pass by the old cul-de-sac every now and then, just to look. I don't even know why. Maybe I keep hoping I'll see something that makes it all make sense. This happened when I was 10, on Christmas Day. We just finished opening gifts. The house still smelled like cinnamon rolls and pine needles, and I was riding high off the sugar and excitement of getting my very first real bike, a red BMX with black grips and pegs. I remember tearing open the garage door and yelling, "I'm going to ride it!" My dad hollered after me, "Stay in the cul-de-sac!" But I was already gone. Tires squealing on the driveway. The cul-de-sac was shaped like a lollipop. Our house was halfway down the stick. At the end of the circle, there was a slope that dipped sharply into a blind corner where the neighborhood road met a bigger, faster one. You couldn't see what was coming until you were already in the street. It was quiet that morning. Christmas Day, early. Barely any cars. The sun was bright but low, casting long shadows off the pine trees. I remember laughing and pushing the pedals as hard as I could. That feeling, pure speed, wind in your face, it felt like flying. I whipped around the circle once, twice. Then I got cocky. I stood up on the pedals and aimed straight down the slope, out of the cul-de-sac. No hesitation, no looking. Halfway down, I heard it. Not a sound I recognized at first, just this high whine rising fast. I didn't process it. I was too focused on keeping my handlebars straight. Then there was a flash, a reflection off a windshield, coming around the blind curve, a white SUV barreling fast. I don't remember screaming. I don't remember thinking. There wasn't time, but something happened. I didn't fall. I didn't swerve. I didn't turn. I was moved. I don't know how else to say it. I was pedaling hard. I had momentum. There was no way I could have just stopped or jumped off. But one second I was going straight into the street, and the next, without any break in motion, I was in the grass off to the right of the driveway, like someone had picked me up midair and set me down. The car missed me by maybe a foot. It didn't brake until it was past the cul-de-sac. Then it stopped hard. I looked back, confused, panting. My bike was tilted halfway into a bush, and I had no memory of turning or jumping or anything. Then I saw my dad. He was standing at the top of the driveway, white-faced, completely still. Not yelling, not moving, just staring. The driver, a middle-aged guy in a blue shirt, jumped out and ran over to him. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I remember how the guy's hands were shaking as he talked. He kept looking over at me. His eyes were wide like he was in shock. I pushed my bike up and slowly walked back toward the garage. My dad still hadn't moved. I asked, "What happened?" He didn't answer right away. Then finally he said, "You were dead. You should have been dead." That's all he said. Inside the house, Mom kept asking what was wrong, but neither of us really answered. I just remember sitting on the couch with my hot chocolate going cold, hands still shaking. I didn't ride the bike again for a week. Later that night, my dad came into my room. He was quiet for a long time. Then he said, "I saw it." I asked, "Saw what?" He hesitated. "You didn't jump out of the way. You didn't stop. You were in the road and then you weren't. It was like you were pulled, yanked, but nothing touched you." I asked if maybe he just imagined it. He'd been scared after all, but he shook his head. "It was like something invisible grabbed your whole body midair and tossed you off course." I didn't know what to say to that. Still don't. Here's the part I never told anyone else, not even him. In that split second before I got moved, right before the car would have hit me, I felt something cold, like a hand. Not on my shoulder, not on my leg. It was like something gripped my entire chest from behind. Not squeezing, holding. And it whispered something I couldn't understand, right into my left ear. It didn't sound human. That's the best way I can describe it. The whisper was too low and too fast, like words were spilling backwards. And it wasn't outside my ear. It was inside it. And then I was on the grass. Later, I tracked down the driver. I found his name from an old neighborhood directory my mom kept. I emailed him, just said I was the kid from the Christmas Day bike incident and wanted to ask him something. He replied the same night. Said he remembered. Said he thought about it every year. Said he was 100% sure he'd hit me. Swore he saw my body going under the front grill. But there was no impact, no dent, no sound. Just nothing. Then I was gone. Said it was the single weirdest thing he'd ever experienced. He ended the email with, "I don't believe in ghosts, but I also don't believe in impossible things happening. And what happened that day was impossible." I never replied. There's one more thing. I looked at some old photos from that Christmas morning. There was one taken right before I rode off. I'm holding my bike, grinning at the camera. Behind me, just barely visible through the garage window, is the street. And in the reflection of that window, there's something standing at the edge of the cul-de-sac. Not a person, not quite. It's tall, blurry, almost like smoke. Long arms, no face, but there's a clear outline of it, like it's watching. I asked a friend to look at it. He said it was probably glare, but it's not glare, because I have another photo taken a split second later. different angle. But that same shape is still there. Same spot, same thing. I deleted the photos. I don't want them anymore. I don't want proof. I already know something pulled me out of that road. Story 9. We were coming back from my cousin's birthday party in Bakersfield. My mom, me, and my little sister asleep in the back seat. It was already past 10 p.m., and we still had a long drive back to Kettleman City. I remember waking up when the car suddenly jerked. My mom swore under her breath and eased it onto the shoulder. We rolled to a stop on the side of the 5, surrounded by nothing but dark open farmland. Our old Camry had just quit. No warning lights, no sputtering. It was like something just switched it off. I sat up groggy, rubbing my eyes. What happened? Car died, Mom muttered, trying to start it again. It didn't even turn over. Just a click. She pulled out my dad's old Nokia, which she borrowed since hers had no battery, and called him. I could hear him over the speaker. He was annoyed but said he'd head out and be there in about 30 minutes. 30 minutes felt like a week to a 10-year-old, sitting in the dark with only the faint hum of highway traffic way off behind us. Can I play Snake? I asked. She hesitated, then handed it to me. Just 5 minutes. Don't kill the battery. I didn't even make it to the third apple. The phone died in my hands. It was quiet after that. No radio, no light, no other cars nearby. I kept looking out the window at the rows of crops stretching out into blackness. My mom stayed still, both hands on the wheel, eyes fixed ahead. We sat there like that for maybe 20 minutes. I had dozed off again when I noticed lights, headlights in the side mirror, pulling up behind us. I think that's Dad, I said, sitting up. But the car that pulled in wasn't my dad's truck. It was this older-looking red Chevy, dented on one side, headlight out. It stopped maybe 15 feet behind us. A man stepped out, tall and skinny, wearing jeans and a work shirt. He had a flashlight in one hand and walked slow, like he was trying not to scare us. But it had the opposite effect. My mom rolled her window down a little, just enough to talk through. Car trouble? The man asked. His voice was too calm, like he already knew. My husband's on the way, my mom said right away. I can take a look if you want. She shook her head. No, he's close. Shouldn't be long. He nodded but didn't leave. He just stood there smiling. He had this weird fixed grin, way too wide, like he'd been holding it too long. And his eyes. I don't even know how to explain them. They didn't match the smile. He wasn't looking at my mom. He was looking past her, into the back seat, right at me. I sank down. You sure? He asked again. It's real easy. Just a loose wire, maybe. Number. Thank you, she said louder. Her voice had this edge now. The man didn't move. He stood there for another second, then finally nodded and started walking back to his car. But right before he got in, he stopped. Then he turned around and walked right back to the window. He leaned in closer this time, just inches from the glass. My mom was about to say something when he said, real quiet, actually, it was your husband who called me to help you. The way he said it, it wasn't a question or a guess. It was a statement, calm, certain. I remember my stomach flipping. The air felt cold all of a sudden. My mom froze. She didn't blink, didn't say a word. I started crying without even realizing it. I remember saying, Mom, he's lying, right? Dad didn't. He didn't call him, right? But she didn't answer me. She was just staring straight ahead, one hand tightening on the wheel like she was bracing for something. The man stood there a second longer, then just turned around, walked to his car, and got in. He pulled away slowly, his headlights off. About 10 seconds later, another car came up fast behind us. I could see the silhouette of my dad's ball cap before he even stepped out. Mom jumped out and ran to him. I couldn't hear everything she said, but her voice cracked, and she kept pointing toward the road. Dad looked over her shoulder, confused, then grabbed the Nokia from her hand. He pressed the power button. Nothing. Dead. He said you called him, my mom said. That's what he told me. My dad looked at her like she lost her mind. We don't know anyone who drives a red Chevy, he said. I didn't call anybody. She didn't argue. She just looked down the road the way the car had gone. I never forgot the man's face, his grin frozen like he was wearing it for someone else. His voice didn't match it.
Neither did his eyes. He wasn't trying to help. I don't know what he was trying to do, but I know for sure that if my dad had been a minute later, we wouldn't be talking about this as just a scare. We didn't talk about it much after. My mom didn't even want us bringing it up. She just said he didn't belong there. I don't know what she meant by that, but I believe her. Story 10. I don't usually take Belridge Road. If you live around El Centro, California, you probably wouldn't either. It's narrow, runs through old farmland, and has this weird stretch with no cell signal for miles. My regular commute to the college is 15 minutes, straight down Interstate 8, but that morning something made me take the alternate way. I don't even remember consciously deciding. I just turned. I was running late, yeah, but not enough to gamble with a new route. It was like my hands had a mind of their own. I remember passing the sign for Belridge and feeling this strange pressure in my ears, like I'd climbed too fast in a plane. Then everything went really quiet, like someone had hit mute on the world. About 5 minutes in, I realized I hadn't passed a single car. No one coming, no one behind me. Just empty road, low yellow grass on either side, and these broken down irrigation pipes stretching out into nothing. That quiet, it wasn't right, it wasn't peaceful. It felt like the world was waiting for something to happen. Then I blacked out. I don't remember drifting. No warning signs. I wasn't tired. I don't even remember my vision dimming. Just a snap. 1 second I was driving, and the next I was pulled out of myself, like I'd been yanked backward through a tunnel. But I saw everything. I wasn't in my body anymore. I saw my car veer into the other lane, slow, like it was floating. My head slumped to the side, eyes wide open but not seeing. I watched it all happen from above, like a drone's eye view, spinning slowly in the air. Then the worst part, someone else was in the driver's seat. I know how that sounds, but I swear to God, it wasn't me behind the wheel anymore. He looked like me, same hoodie, same hands, but the way he moved, jerky, mechanical, like a puppet someone was yanking around by invisible strings. His head twitched side to side, like he was listening to music I couldn't hear, mouth opening and closing just slightly, grinning. That's what did it. He was smiling. The car started speeding up, not by much, just enough to be noticeable. 40, then 50, then 60. The road wasn't made for those speeds. I could see the curves up ahead, tight and blind with ditches on both sides. My real self, whatever part of me was watching, started panicking. I tried screaming, but I didn't have a mouth. I wasn't in a body. And that thing pretending to be me? It started laughing. The car hit 70, 80. It was going to flip. I could feel it. And that's when I noticed something else. There were other people on the road. No cars, just people. Standing still in the field, shoulder to shoulder, all facing the road. They weren't moving, just watching. I don't know how long they'd been there. I hadn't seen them before. Their clothes were torn, like they'd crawled out of somewhere, wet and deep. Their eyes, those were the worst. Hollow. Not in the poetic sense. I mean literally empty. Just black holes where their eyes should have been. And they were smiling too. I didn't understand what was happening, but I knew that if the car kept going, I was going to die. Not crash and maybe survive. I mean die. Like my soul was going to get erased. The puppet me jerked the wheel hard left, aiming straight toward a power pole. It wasn't trying to avoid it. It was aiming for it. Then something pulled me back. Not gently either. It was like getting slammed through ice water. My vision returned in flashes. Hands clenched, muscles spasming. My foot hit the brake hard. Tires screamed. I remember the impact. Soft, almost like the car had been caught in a net. And then I stopped, half on the road, half in a ditch. I started screaming. Just screaming. No words, I couldn't stop. Next thing I knew, there was a police officer tapping on my window. I didn't even see the lights or hear the sirens. Just his shape outside the glass, blurred like a dream. I rolled the window down and said, I didn't do it. I wasn't driving. He thought I was drunk or on something until the ambulance showed up. Apparently, people had called 911 after seeing me swerve all over the road. Some thought I'd fallen asleep. Others said it looked like I was having a seizure. But one guy, He said something I'll never forget. He told the cops, it looked like he was possessed. They laughed it off, but the guy wasn't joking. He said he saw my face through the windshield and something about the way I was smiling made him stop his truck and get out. It didn't look human, he told the EMT. His face wasn't moving right, and his eyes, they were way too wide. They ran tests, brain scans, blood work, overnight observation, nothing. No seizure, no neurological issues, no drugs, no explanation. Everyone dropped it eventually. Even I tried to. But sometimes I drive past Belridge and I see them again. Those people in the fields. Not always, but sometimes. Just standing there, watching, waiting. I've never taken that road again.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.